The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. The question of whether or not we're alone in the universe is one of the oldest that's ever been asked by mankind. It stretches back to the dawn of history, but for the greater part of that time, it lay firmly in the province of religion and philosophy. 50 years ago last week, it became part of science. That was when a little-known American astronomer by the name of Frank Drake decided to start sweeping the skies with a radio telescope in West Virginia in the hope of stumbling across a radio message from ET. That was the start of an ambitious program, which is now an international effort, called SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And 50 years of SETI seems like a good time to take stock. And so my book, The Eerie Silence, is not just a retrospective of 50 years of heroic effort, but an attempt to rethink the entire enterprise and to relaunch it, and in particular, to widen it. In other words, to find new ways of tracking down ET, if ET is indeed out there. Now, this is the young Frank Drake, 1960. I have to say that Frank is one of my heroes. I dedicate the book to him. There are not many other people who could design an experiment, run it for 50 years, get a null result, and still be cheerful. Frank is still in the game. He's well into his 70s. He's still an active SETI astronomer, and he's still as upbeat as ever about the future and about the possibilities of success. So a real optimist. SETI then addresses this question of whether or not there's anybody out there. And I think most people's understanding of this subject probably comes from the movie Contact, starring Jodie Foster. It was based on a novel by Carl Sagan. And it more or less follows the way in which the SETI search is really done. Now, a number of radio telescopes have been involved in this. This is one in Australia. It's the Parkes Radio Telescope in New South Wales. It was famous from the movie The Dish. Some of you may have seen that. And then this is the Arecibo Radio Telescope in Puerto Rico. It's the world's biggest, and that's often used for SETI. It's sculpted out of the landscape, and so it's not a steerable dish. It just points straight up into the sky, but as the Earth turns, it monitors a strip of sky above it. And that was famous not only by featuring in the movie Contact, but also in the James Bond movie GoldenEye. So this is very much a sort of movie-oriented topic. Most of the research these days is managed by the SETI Institute. That's located in California, close to NASA's Ames Astrobiology Laboratory, I guess you would say. And I want to say right at the outset that today SETI doesn't cost the taxpayer anything. It's entirely privately funded. Most of the funding comes from Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft. And he's given $35 million for the construction of a dedicated network of radio telescopes that's currently under construction at Hutt Creek in Northern California. And you see these are like rough and ready dishes, which when they're connected together form a collecting area equivalent to what will be the biggest dish in the world. And so this is going to greatly increase the sensitivity of the observing. Okay, well, after 50 years, what have the astronomers got to show for it? Well, nothing, of course, as the book title says, nothing more than an eerie silence. So what does that mean? Does it mean that we are, in fact, alone in the universe after all? Or might we be looking for the wrong thing in the wrong place at the wrong time? Should we be doing something different? Well, there's a fundamental problem with the whole basis of SETI as it's so far done. And the problem is that E.T. doesn't know we're here. The reason for that is nothing travels faster than light. If we take a civilization 1,000 light years away, and that is actually quite close, even by SETI optimist standards, someone on this hypothetical planet 1,000 light years away doesn't see Earth as it is today, but as it was 1,000 years ago. And there were no radio telescopes here 1,000 years ago. So there's no particular reason that this hypothetical community should be beaming messages at us at this time. You imagine a SETI enthusiast on some distant planet 1,000 light years away going to a grant agency saying, we'd like some money to begin transmitting to that promising-looking planet over there, Earth. They'd say, well, we've studied Earth and we've got these wonderful instruments and we can see it quite clearly and we can see the Great Wall of China and we can see the pyramids, and we figure that any millennium soon they're going to be building radio telescopes. And I can tell you what the grant agency would say. They'd say, well, you know, that's a great idea, it's a great project, but come back in a few millennia when you know that they actually have the capability of picking up our signals. And how will they know? Well, they will know only when our first signals reach them. So radio technology on Earth is a little over 100 years old, and every time there's a radio or television broadcast, some of that leaks out into space. We can't do anything about that. We can't get them back. And in about another 900 years, our first feeble attempts with radio will reach this hypothetical civilization 1,000 light years away. And then it would take them another 1,000 years to send their message to us. So this way of doing SETI is a great idea, but it's perhaps about 2,000 years too soon. Now, when I say that the nearest civilization is likely to be 1,000 light years away, nobody knows how far away, and nobody knows if there are any civilizations out there. I'm going on the figure that Frank Drake has given us because he's the optimist, and he estimates 10,000 communicating civilizations in the galaxy at this time, and that would place the nearest one to be about 1,000 light years away. To put this in context, our galaxy, the Milky Way, has about 400 billion stars, and the SETI people have only so far searched a few thousand. And when I say search, that is they've pointed a radio telescope at a few thousand stars and listened in, sometimes for not more than about half an hour at a time. They can, however, monitor up to 1 billion radio channels simultaneously. So the frequency on which ET might be transmitting isn't really a critical factor anymore. So this makes it look pretty hopeless, the idea that there would be messages deliberately beamed at Earth by some benevolent advanced civilization out there. That just doesn't seem to make a great deal of sense. So does that mean that SETI really is a waste of time and money? Well, not at all, because there are other things that we could look for. And in particular, if we give up the idea of deliberately directed messages, we could look for beacons. Beacons are things that are, it's a one-way communication. A lighthouse is a beacon. It's there for anybody who happens to see it. And you know that it's an artificial source because it repeats periodically. So could ET have built a beacon sweeping the plane of the galaxy with either light or radio waves, and then might we pick up such a thing? A beacon might be created by a long-vanished civilization as a monument or as a warning or just a greeting, just any means of attracting our attention. We could look for beacons. The problem is that the SETI program, as it is presently set up, is not well adapted to do that. It means you really need to have a radio telescope to stare at a given patch of sky for months or years on end. Otherwise, if you just get a pulse, it's just something that goes bleep in the night, you can't be sure it's ET trying to ping us. To be sure of that, you have to pick it up on a regular basis. You know, ping, and then a couple of years later, ping. And if this keeps happening, then you could be pretty sure that that's a beacon. So far, that's not something that they're well equipped to do. Now, let me turn to this question about how many civilizations are out there, because I mentioned that Frank Drake said there are 10,000, and here is Frank standing in front of his eponymous equation, the Drake equation. And it's not a real equation. This is not an equation in the usual physics sense of the term. This is just a collection of factors that go to determine how many civilizations might be there. And really, it's a collection of things we don't know. Some of the terms in that equation are quite well known. The first term is the rate of star formation. We actually have pinned that down quite well. It's about 7 stars per year in the Milky Way that get created. The second term is the fraction of stars on which planets form. When Frank began this 50 years ago, nobody knew the answer to that. But just over the last 10 or 15 years, we've been able to discover planets going around other stars, and there's a list of about 450 of them now known. But better still, this satellite system called Kepler is up there at the moment, and that's searching. It's a much better system. That's searching 300,000 stars for signs of planets going around them, and should compile a catalogue pretty soon. So the prevailing view is now most planets will have stars, and most stars will have planets, and most of those will have Earth-like planets, other Earths. There could be a billion or more other Earths in our galaxy alone. A billion or more. That's a lot of real estate. But notice what I say at the bottom. Habitable is not the same as inhabited. Just because you have another Earth doesn't mean you're going to have life on it. It all hinges on the question of how life began and how likely it is that life began. Well, Darwin himself, 151 years ago, was tackled on the question of how life began, and he said it is mere rubbish at this time, talking about the origin of life. One might as well talk about the origin of matter. Well, it's interesting that physicists can now explain the origin of matter, but they can't yet explain the origin of life. There's no theory of the origin of life. Excuse me. We have a very good theory of how life evolves once it gets going, but no agreed theory of how it actually got started in the first place. And I have to say, because it was a long time ago, we may never have a blow-by-blow account of how life on Earth got started from non-life. We may never know the details. But we don't need to know the details to answer the question, are we alone in the universe? What we would like to know is, was the process very likely or very unlikely? Was it just some sort of random fluke? Or does life emerge more or less automatically given Earth-like conditions? And there are distinguished scientists prepared to argue for both. When I was a student, just after Frank Drake began this quest, the prevailing view was that life on Earth was a stupendously improbable freak accident, unique in the universe, that there would be no life elsewhere because the conditions necessary for that accident would never be replicated. In fact, Francis Crick, the co-discoverer of DNA, said life seems almost a miracle, so many are the conditions necessary for it to get going. Today, the pendulum has swung the other way. So another distinguished biologist, Christian De Duve, is able to say that life is a cosmic imperative, that it will crop up wherever there are Earth-like conditions. Well, how can we test if that's true? The whole of this SETI program is predicated on the assumption that life pops up readily all around the universe, so there's going to be lots of life, lots of planets with life, and some with intelligent life, and some with radio transmitters. How can we test that fundamental assumption that life is a cosmic imperative? So I devote a great deal of the book to that. One way of testing it is if, of course, we find a second sample of life, what Chris McKay at NASA Ames calls life 2.0. We know life 1.0. Here it is. What we want is life 2.0. We want a different form of life belonging to a different tree of life starting from a different genesis event. We want to be sure that life has happened more than once. If it's happened twice, if we discover two forms, it's most unlikely that the universe would just have two. It's either going to have one, it's either going to be incredibly improbable, or it's going to be everywhere. It's an all or nothing thing. So how can we search for life 2.0? Where do we look? Well, one possibility is, of course, SETI itself. If that should succeed, then we would have our answer. Another way is if we follow up after the Kepler mission with a space-based system that has enough power to form images of those Earth-like planets that Kepler will find with enough resolution to see if they have gases in their atmosphere that are telltale signs of life, like oxygen. That's a long way ahead. It'll be a very, very expensive mission. But it may happen, maybe in 100 years. We might go to Mars. That's another possibility. Suppose we go to Mars and find there's life there. Doesn't that mean we have two samples of life? Well, not necessarily, as this picture shows us. Mars gets hit from time to time by comets and asteroids with enough force to splatter rocks all around the solar system. Some of those rocks come to Earth, and if there was life on Mars, it could hitch a ride in those rocks and come to Earth as well. It's quite likely that life on Earth didn't actually begin on Earth, that it began on Mars and came here in that manner. So Earth and Mars must really be considered part of the same extended ecosystem. So what can we do then to test the cosmic imperative? I think there is a very direct way in which we could find life 2.0. No planet is more Earth-like than Earth itself. So if life really does start readily under Earth-like conditions, surely it should have started many times over right here on our home planet. How do we know it didn't? Has anybody actually looked? Remarkably, until about 3 or 4 years ago, nobody had thought to look for life on Earth, but not as we know it. Now, let me say right at the outset that almost all life on Earth consists of microbes. You don't notice the microbes, so you tend to overlook them. But the vast majority of species on our planet are just microbes. And the microbial realm is still largely a mystery. We've only just scratched the surface of it. We don't know whether among all those squillions and squillions of microbes all around us, some of them may be truly alien organisms. Alien, not in the sense of necessarily coming from space, though they may have done, as I just mentioned, life could have started on Mars, but alien in the sense of being independent, a different form of life, different tree of life, different origin of life. If we found that life on Earth had started at least twice, then the cosmic imperative would be assured. So I think we should go look for life 2.0 right here on Earth. I think it's the most important thing we can do in trying to move this whole SETI quest forward. So we call this the shadow biosphere, the idea that intermingled among the microbes that we know as familiar life, like the bacteria, for example, might be microbes which are truly alien in the sense that they would have a completely different biochemistry. You can't tell by looking at a microbe what makes it tick. You've got to delve into its innards and study its biochemistry to say whether it's our form of life or some different form of life. So I often say there could be aliens right under our noses or even up our noses if these things are all around. We would, so far, the point being that when microbiologists go looking for microbes, they look for microbes as we know it. That is, if you go looking for A, it's no surprise you find A and you don't find B. What we want is B. We want life 2.0. Where should we look? Well, here's one place a colleague of mine is looking. It's Mono Lake in California. Here she is, seen wearing a hat. This is Felisa Wolf-Simon. She has the clever idea that maybe another form of life would use different elements from the ones that we know. Now, carbon, I think, is inevitable. All life, I think, will have to have carbon. But among the other elements that known life uses is phosphorus, which is a somewhat rare element. She thinks arsenic could take the place of phosphorus. So she's looking for arsenic life in Mono Lake. And she thinks she's found it. Here's a picture of arsenic life. It's too soon to say that this isn't just a bizarre side branch in the known tree of life. Too soon to say that this is life 2.0. It might just be a variant of life 1.0. We can't say. But anyway, that's the picture she sent. The name she's given to these microorganisms, which is culturing in the lab with no phosphorus and lots of arsenic, and they love the arsenic, GFAJ. I called her the other day and said, Felisa, what's this GFAJ mean? And she said, oh, it means give Felisa a job. So she's just a young postdoc, but if she really has found arsenic life, she won't have any trouble getting a job. So what should we do then, coming back to bring this to a conclusion, what should we do other than looking for microbes on Earth for this whole SETI project. Well, I believe that whilst I hope that the SETI people go on looking for messages from ET, because they do it well and I think they can do it better, I'm not saying they should stop. But meanwhile, I think we should broaden the search and not just look for messages, but look for any general signatures of intelligence. What do I mean by this? Well, all technology leaves a footprint of some sort. For example, terrestrial technology leaves a very well-known footprint, namely global warming. That's something you could detect from a long way away. Presumably, a civilization that's been around for millions and millions of years is likely to have a footprint that extends beyond its home planet into its surrounding astronomical environment. And there are all sorts of things that we could look for. My book is a wake-up call to the scientific community and the general public to come to me with their ideas about what we might look for. And I'm saying anything fishy. I mean, basically, anything that looks like it could not have a natural explanation. Any sort of oddity, anomaly, might be a signature of technology. As you know, at the scene of a crime, the detective, Sherlock Holmes, for example, has the responsibility of determining, did this person die of natural causes or was there some skullduggery? And the clues to the skullduggery can often be very subtle and require a range of sciences to unravel. And the same thing here. The clues to alien technology may be very subtle. We may not notice them at first glance, but they may be buried in the data and require careful analysis and the best tools of our science to unravel. Now, obviously, if we saw something like this, it would be a dead giveaway, or something like this. Rather more seriously, Freeman Dyson some years ago suggested that a very advanced civilization might build a shell of matter around its star to trap all of its starlight. So this would be like a solar energy project with a vengeance. You'd capture all of the starlight. And such a Dyson sphere, as it's called, would betray its presence by glowing in the infrared. And astronomers have looked with infrared satellites. They haven't seen a Dyson sphere yet. But it gives an example of how large-scale astroengineering might be very conspicuous. But if the engineering is on a more subtle scale, might be rather harder to track down. But we need to think of ways in which we can do that. Now, we're not just restricted to looking way, way out across the galaxy. There's another scenario that might lead us to discover that we are not alone in the universe. And that is to look for general signatures of intelligence, that is something fishy, down here, by which I mean in our immediate astronomical vicinity, within the solar system, and maybe even on Earth itself. Now, about 60 years ago, the famous physicist Enrico Fermi suddenly over lunch one day asked the question, where is everybody? Here's a picture of Fermi on a postage stamp, so he must be famous. What he meant by where is everybody was the following, that Earth is only 4.5 billion years old. The galaxy is 13 billion years old. There were stars and planets around long before Earth even existed. There's been plenty of time, if there are going to be intelligent communities out there, plenty of time for them to have evolved long before Earth even existed. And there's been plenty of time for them to explore the galaxy, to come to Earth, either to colonize it or to visit it. And Fermi was saying, well, as far as we can see, the aliens have never come to Earth, so they don't exist. But how can we be sure that the aliens have never come to Earth? How will we know? And the big problem here is the huge time factor. So would they have left a calling card or a message in a bottle? Now, the big problem is the time scale. We have to think not in thousands or millions of years, but hundreds of millions or even billions of years. So let's just take 100 million years as an example. Would anything survive 100 billion years? Would a calling card survive that long? The answer is not very much. Notice that 100 million years is long even by Raquel Welch standards. She was only 1 million years BC. Would anything survive? Well, a few things might. And in my book, I've dredged a few things up. Nuclear waste would survive. We'd recognize that after 100 million years. Large-scale quarrying might, but it would be buried beneath overlying rock strata. It's another idea which I think is neat. It's completely crazy, but in line with the fun of this subject. I thought of it, so I'm responsible for this bad idea, that ET encoding messages in radio waves is one way to go, but is there another way that a message could be got to us? Well, there is. There's the message-in-the-bottle concept. When you put a message in a bottle and throw it out to sea, it's not with any particular recipient in mind. You don't know if anybody would ever find it, and if they do, you don't know who they are, and you don't expect to get a reply. Could ET have left a message in a bottle for us? Well, maybe. We should go look. What would the bottle be? Well, one bottle, which I think would work very well, are living cells. Cells are wonderful bottles because they contain messages called DNA, and they replicate and repair themselves and survive for millions and millions of years. We have genes inside us that have information that's remained largely unchanged for 3 billion years. So enormous longevity. So it's a great way to go. If you can upload your message into the genome of a living organism, it'll just replicate and replicate and be preserved almost forever. So could ET have done this? Might a robot or a space probe or even a flesh and blood being itself have come to Earth, say, 100 million years ago, uploaded a message into the DNA of some terrestrial microbes and left it for us to find? Has anybody looked? Not really. There's one attempt, but we're sequencing genomes anyway. We might as well take a look and see if there's a message from ET. It might be something along the lines of, "Hello, Earthlings, have I got news for you?" We don't know. Nobody's thought to look. Now, am I seriously suggesting there are messages in the genomes? Maybe inside us. Maybe the truth is inside us. Am I seriously suggesting it? Well, what I'm saying is that this is the type of thing we need to think about. Looking in peculiar places, not just leave it to a band of radio astronomers to do this, but right across the sciences, looking in all the possible places that a message or a signal or a footprint, it may be an inadvertent footprint, may lurk. I just want to bring this to an end by saying that this entire subject is plagued by a sort of anthropocentrism. Some of you may have seen this movie, Avatar. It's not hard to recognize what the aliens are supposed to represent. And even ET looks very humanoid, like a cuddly creature. In other words, our conception of alien intelligence is really based on the notion of human beings, maybe with bigger heads or something. However, from what we know of the evolution of our own technology, this seems extremely unlikely. Already, more and more of the intellectual heavy lifting on Earth are being done by machines. Computers can play chess and do arithmetic much better than almost everybody on the planet, and Google is surely smarter than any individual. Within a few decades, it's really very likely that most of the really important decision-making and information processing and good ideas are going to come from networked, designed intelligence. Not necessarily machine intelligence, because some of the information processing of the future may be combining neurons with electronics, artificial systems. And these, in turn, will design more systems and so on. Where will it all end if these things get networked? Maybe with the entire surface of a moon or planet covered with information processing networks of some sort. So if ET is out there, the chances are it's going to be a gigantic, throbbing, planet-wide megabrain and not a flesh-and-blood being with a big head. And that leads us to the whole question about, would an entity like this, inhabiting, as it would, the outer reaches of the intellectual universe, have any interest in us? Would it be bothering to try and communicate? I somehow doubt it. So why do SETI? Is the whole thing really a ridiculous, anthropocentric waste of time? Well, I think there is an anthropocentric component. I think part of the reason that people do SETI is because it's, in effect, a search for ourselves. It's a search of the universe to see out there, mirrored in the sky, what lies in store for humanity. Because if there have been civilizations that have come and gone in the past, their experiences are likely to be our experiences. If they, for example, blown themselves up after a very short period of time, and the eerie silence is because they no longer exist, they've destroyed themselves before they could send any messages, then that's our likely fate too. If, on the other hand, they've transcended biological intelligence and moved on to this sort of awesome machine intelligence, maybe they're happier exploring cyberspace and have given up worrying about physical space, in which case the silence is not so eerie, although once again it probably means we're going to be handing over to some sort of gigantic computer-type system before very long. So I want to finish just by saying, capturing these sentiments in the work of the man who started this all, my hero, Frank Drake. And so he expresses it so well. He says, SETI is really a search for ourselves, who we are and where we fit into the universe. And I think that's a very good place to stop, and I'm happy to take questions. Thank you. Right. I think we're sort of keeping more or less the time here, a minute or two overrun.
Hi. I know recently there's been a lot of talk of quantum entanglement and exciting applications in it, especially since it's hard to tap into.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, outside of the electromagnetic spectrum, what sort of carriers is SETI looking into?
This quantum entanglement thing, this is not the place to get into what that's all about. You can't use it to send signals faster than light, if that was what you were after. That's a big misconception. But nevertheless, quantum effects could lead to ways of detecting very, very feeble signals. And I have a colleague who, since reading my book, has suggested that we might exploit these so-called quantum weak measurement effects for SETI. It's something that is a classic example of great new thinking that I'm calling for. So that's one possibility. Now, it's just an idea for an idea at this stage. I can't tell you any more. Neutrinos is another possibility that has been suggested. What I think you have to distinguish between is an attempt by an extraterrestrial civilization to attract our attention, in which case they better do it with primitive technology, or we're just not going to notice, and communication between two consenting aliens. And the thing about that is that they could have optimized their internal communication to be something that we would never guess at. And in fact, there's a very good theorem of communication that says that, if I'm communicating with you and I want to encode the data optimally, the most compressed form of the data, to an outside observer, that would appear random. And so all we're going to get is like what sounds like random noise. And so I think the prospects of stumbling across a message intended for somebody else are very slim indeed.
Should there be more networking and a better relationship between SETI and MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network?
SETI people go out of their way to distance themselves from the whole sort of UFO alien abduction scene. And so I felt I should address this issue in my book. What I want to say about that is that I think there is a big difference, that SETI is a thoroughly scientific approach. The UFO scene, fascinating though it is, it's based largely on anecdotes. I didn't want to be dismissive, though, and I spent a great deal of time investigating the UFO stories many years ago. I knew Alan Hynek very well, actually. Alan Hynek was the chief scientific advisor to U.S. Air Force Project Blue Book. I went to his home, and he had thousands of reports in his home, and we went through some of these reports, and I spent a lot of time puzzling over the UFO scene. This is not the time to get into that in a lot of detail, except to say that I think that the most puzzling of the reports are, of course, the alien abduction stories. And I think that the explanation for those lies, in many cases, maybe not all, with sleep disorders like lucid dreaming and sleep paralysis, which I myself have had, so I can attest to the fact that it is something rather like an alien abduction. So that's my take on that, but of course it's a big subject. But I'm not being dismissive about it, as many people are. So I dealt with that in the book and explained why I think it is not alien visitation. However interesting and mysterious it may be, it is not, I think, E.T. visiting us.
Hi. I think it's really interesting that all this being on the microorganism level and being in our backyard. But I kind of think maybe I had this idea first when I was 8 years old.
Ah.
And I read Dr. Seuss, Horton Hears a Who. You familiar
right,
with that?
Right. Yes.
Yeah, I just... I don't know. It just seemed like that was always a real possibility, that the aliens were like this high or much smaller.
Of course, I'm not assuming that that we're dealing with a shadow biosphere of intelligent aliens, simply a shadow biosphere of life which probably started on Earth. So I'm saying it's alien in the sense of belonging to a different tree. So separate origin, separate tree. That's what I mean by alien. Two forms of life here on Earth, maybe both started on Earth, or maybe both started on Mars, or maybe one on each. And there's a natural mechanism for that, because imagine that life gets going on Earth, if it is easy to start, gets going on Earth, in comes a giant asteroid or comet, slams into the Earth, boils the ocean, sterilizes the surface, and a lot of that material gets hurled aloft and goes into orbit around the sun. Some of that will come back maybe 10 million years later, by which time life may have got going again. And when the first lot comes back, it brings back life one. Meanwhile, life two has got going, and then there could be life three and life four. So there's a natural mechanism for life to start up many times on Earth and become intermingled right from the word go. Big question, of course, about whether only one ever survives to the present day. But there's no fundamental reason why there couldn't be several forms of life on Earth. All life so far studied is the same life, belongs to the same tree. But we've only studied a tiny, tiny fraction, so we can't be sure of that. And as I say, nobody's even thought to look for an alternative form of life. The microphone's going back behind you. Next one, I'd like the lady at the front to ask a question.
I have a related question. How would you establish criteria for life 2.0? Because before we discovered these thermophilic microbes that, you know, survive in volcano vents and whatnot.
Right.
We said, oh, life can't exist in these warm,
The extremophiles, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what I do in the book is to outline the whole strategy, and it's not just the book. I've run a workshop on this, and there's a big review paper, and there's about 20 of us involved in this search for life 2.0, and we've got a strategy for finding it. And I'll just give you, I'll bracket this by giving you two examples, because the short answer is, first find the life, then we'll argue about whether it really did have an independent origin. And I'll give you an example at both ends. Supposing we find another form of life that's just like ours, but has a different genetic code, then for my money, that's almost certainly an earlier branch on the known tree of life that has evolved away, split off, we didn't know it was there, but it joins up further back. But now let me give you another striking example, which we've actually looked for. All life, as we know it, has left-handed amino acids and right-handed sugars. That may be, we don't know, an arbitrary symmetry break. It could well be that if life started again, it would have right-handed amino acids and left-handed sugars. We could go look for that, and some colleagues of mine have gone to look for it. Richard Hoover and Elena Pacuta at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville have been running an experiment, which actually my wife suggested, which is to get a bowl of anti-soup, that is a nutrient medium with opposite molecules, which life as we know it would find indigestible, but mirror life would find palatable. And they've got some very interesting results. I don't think they've found mirror life yet, but it's a way to go. It's one way of distinguishing. If they found such a thing, I think we could be pretty sure that that is an independent origin. So it's going to depend on the details. The devil will be in the details, as they say. Oh, right. Could it...
Is there any possibility that instead of being 1.0, we could be 4.0 or 10.0?
Yes,
and if
yes.
That were, what would that mean in terms of a search for, if you will, fossils?
Finding fossilized evidence of different forms of life is harder but not impossible. There are biomarkers that go back, at least 2.5 billion years, so that, for example, the walls of eukaryotic cells leave their molecules called styrenes, which you can still detect in these microfossils. So it's not inconceivable we could find a chemical signature of an alternative form of life in microfossils. Much tougher, of course, than finding extant alternative life, because you've got them under your nose to experiment with. But it's certainly not impossible. Because some people think that at the end of the day, one form of life would win out over all the others. I'm not persuaded by that because, for example, in the microbial realm, we have bacteria, which everybody's familiar with. But another group of organisms, the archaea, look just like bacteria. You can't tell. But they're actually as different from bacteria as they are from us. And yet they've coexisted peacefully for probably 3.5 billion years. One hasn't replaced the other. So in the microbial realm, it's not red in tooth and claw, or cilia and pseudopodia, whatever it would be. But there's much more cooperation and division of labor. So I think it's not obvious that life 2.0 or 3.0 or whatever would be eliminated in our favor. Now, I was told that we couldn't carry on. Is that right? We can't carry on. I mean, we're going to be thrown out of here because there's another even more exciting event, I think. Oh, one more.
You know, unfortunately, we don't have the time. So what we'll do is, what you could do is you can ask Paul upstairs.
Yes, I've got a signed book, so come along and buy a book, and then you can ask your question then.
Please join me in thanking Paul Davey.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.